The news this week was that iPhone will change forever. You talked about iPhones, so it's my turn. From the totally unbiased source, Cult of Mac, we now hear of a new iPhone. Mike Elgin, the one who brings us this news, has this to say. Apple is obsessed, obviously. The company is obsessed with elegant design. They're obsessed with thinness and lightness. They're obsessed with their own logo and visual, organic, word-of-mouth branding. But there's a tragic flaw in the design of Apple, according to Mike Elgin. Their tragic flaw is that these iPhones are so elegant and so nice that they scratch. And so people put cases on them. And when you have a case on an iPhone, the design is gone. So I have an iPhone, and I haven't seen it. And the other day I tried to open up the case, and I couldn't even get it out of the case. So I don't know what the elegant design of an iPhone is like. The Sermon on the Mount is like an iPhone. You knew I was going there. It has a beautiful design. It is of a beautiful life in the kingdom with a beautifully designed Messiah. But this beautiful vision and well-designed moral teaching of Jesus has been encased by the church, by many in the church. Because we're afraid we might scratch it and break it and ruin the faith and hurt our Messiah. So some have thought that this sermon, so beautiful, is for monks and for monastics and for the super rigorous, like Shane Claiborne. But the rest of us will just have to put up with Paul's letters and life in the Spirit. Some have thought that the Sermon on the Mount is like the law on steroids that produces guilt on steroids if you read it well. So we don't read it because we don't want to feel guilty listening to these powerful, beautifully designed and branded words. Some believe that the sermon doesn't fit our theology. So we do a makeover on Jesus. Just a little footnote on this. If our theology doesn't fit the Sermon on the Mount, then we should probably think about getting rid of our theology, not of making Jesus' sermon fit into our theology by hook and crook. Some have thought that Jesus could not possibly have meant this stuff literally. He couldn't, or he wouldn't say these things. Some think the crazies in the church like this text, like Leo Tolstoy and the Jesus people of the 60s and 70s in California. They prove that we need to avoid the Sermon on the Mount because of the way they lived. Some think it is only for the Jews of the first century. I once got a phone call from a lady at 6 a.m. in the morning. She asked me if she woke me up. And I said, no, I was coming to the phone to get the phone. I discovered that she was rather intense because she was from California, which meant it was 4 a.m., and I think she had been stewing all night and found my phone number in the phone book and called me. She told me in rather bold terms, before we had even exchanged hellos, that the sign of a heretic was that they loved the book of James, the book of Hebrews, and the Sermon on the Mount. She had me in a corner. That semester, I was teaching Hebrews and James, and I was scheduled to teach the Sermon on the Mount that summer. But she was convinced that these books were for heretics. I can tell you more about that at another time. Francis Spufford, a recent English writer who wrote a book called Unapologetic, described Christianity through the lens of the Sermon on the Mount like this. Christianity does something different. It makes frankly impossible demands. Instead of asking for specific actions, it offers general but lunatic principles. It thinks you should give your possessions away, refuse to defend yourself, love strangers as much as your family, and behave as if there's no tomorrow. Spufford is closer with his lunatic principles to the unencased Sermon on the Mount than my California phone caller. So we put the sermon in a padded case and put it in our pocket and hope that Jesus doesn't call. What we most fear about the Sermon on the Mount is the thing we fear most, that he just might mean what he says. And so I would like to talk about the Sermon on the Mount in general today. That was a long text to preach through, even more involved than most. And I want to say that we've wrapped it up. We've done everything we can to hide it, to soften it, and repackage it so that it's rugged, scary, bold and bright, but piercing beauty can't be seen. A Jewish rabbi scholar who specializes in New Testament studies, there are people like this. His name is Pinchas Lapida, wrote a book about the Sermon on the Mount. And after he had studied the history of Christian interpretation of this sermon, opened his book with these bell-ringing words: "The history of the impact of the Sermon on the Mount can largely be described in terms of an attempt to domesticate everything in it that is shocking, demanding, and uncompromising, and so render it harmless." It's the case we put it in so that it doesn't speak. "Hear, hear," we might now say, or as my son sometimes says, "get out." That's what I hear sometimes when we read the sermon. But yes, like Francis Spufford and Rabbi Pinchas Lapida, we need to have the kinds of ears that they have to hear what Jesus said. Now that I have everyone wondering how crazy and lunatic I might get today, I would only say, hang on, folks, we're going down a rapids in an old kayak. This is powerful stuff that we're not prepared for. And the first thing I would like to say about approaching the Sermon on the Mount is that this greatest sermon in history was given an interpretation by the author Matthew so that we might know how to read it. And because we tend to be Bible verse readers than book readers, I want to call your attention to some verses at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and much later than the Sermon on the Mount, because this was a very Jewish way of organizing a book, so that we would know how to hear this sermon. I don't know what time I'm supposed to finish, Jay, but this is the Sermon on the Mount. And I grew up Baptist, and we didn't have those things at the back of our church. When you were done, you just kept going. Matthew 4:23 reads like this: "Jesus went throughout Galilee." He did three things: teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. Matthew 4:23. This is called the beginning of an organizing pattern so that you will know what's coming. But so that you know just how important this is to Matthew, in Matthew 9:35, we read these words: "Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, and now this is absolutely identical in Greek, teaching in all their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing pasan nasan kai pasan malakia. And there are some charismatics in here, but I'm going to interpret it for myself. Healing all sicknesses and diseases. This is a beautiful little Greek expression that shows up only one other time in Matthew chapter 10, 2, when Matthew wants to usher the disciples into the same ministry that Jesus did. So Matthew tells us what he's going to tell us, and then he tells us, and then when he's done telling us, he tells us that he told us. Jesus is going to do three things. He's going to teach, he's going to preach, and he's going to heal. Chapters 8 and 9, very clearly, are the healing ministry of Jesus. Chapters 5 to 7 are the preaching and teaching ministry of Jesus. So by the time we get to 935 in the first century Jewish world, we say, Matthew has just explained to us Jesus. I like to see this section in Matthew as evangelism. Here's Jesus. Take him or leave him, but here he is. And the Sermon on the Mount becomes, here's Jesus' teachings. And the end of the Sermon on the Mount is either do these things or don't do these things. And we play with this with our children. The wise man built his house upon a rock and they all fall down in hell. Because that's what he's describing here when the people who are foolish don't respond to the sermon. So here we have Matthew presenting Jesus. So the first thing that we should do when we get done with the Sermon on the Mount is be impressed, which is exactly where Matthew ends. When he finished these words, they said they were amazed because he taught them as one who had authority, not like the scribes and the Pharisees. So they were impressed with Jesus. But there's something more here that happens. Matthew 5:1 begins with a rather interesting expression. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside. I would like you to come with me to heaven. And we're going to hear a conversation that I've made up that is totally true. It's between Peter and Matthew and Luke. And they're kibitzing with their feet in a mikvah in heaven. Kibitzing about halakha and Torah, all right? Talking about the Bible. And Matthew leans over to Peter and he says, Peter, did you ever read my Sermon on the Mount? And Peter said, I died before you wrote that. Do you remember? And Matthew says, it was a long time ago. I don't remember. And then he says, I want you to read it. And Peter opens it up and he begins to read and he reads this. He went up on a mountain. And Peter thinks, mountain? On the north side of Galilee? Mountain? So he leans over to Luke and he says to Luke, Luke, what did you say? And Luke said, well, Matthew, I said he gave these on a plain. And I think it is a plain. And then Peter looks at Matthew and he says, Matthew, that was really clever. I like that. Because it is not a mountain. If you've been to the north side of Galilee and Capernaum, it's a slope. It's a Midwestern slope. We know mountains. We get to Colorado and we all just go gape-jawed and say, this is really cool. There are no mountains on the north side of Galilee unless you go way up there. It's a slope. So Peter says, I think I know what you're doing. I think you want us to think that this Jesus that we're encountering is like Moses, who also went on a mountain. And the end of the Sermon on the Mount ends with words that are from Exodus chapter 24. Moses went up on a mountain, and when Moses was done, Exodus says he came down from the mountain And in Greek, it's the identical words that Matthew uses. He wants us to see that Jesus has ascended the mountain. It's not a mountain, it's a slope. But for Midwesterners, it's enough for us to call it a mountain. But it's literary, and it's clever, and it's revealing. Because he's not saying it's a mountain. He's saying Jesus is Moses-like. This is the new Moses ascending the new Sinai to give the new law for the new people of God. And this becomes our word. This is the word for us. This is the law 2.0 upgrade so that we will know how to live in the kingdom of God. So it is clever and it is shrewd, but it is revealing of who Jesus is. Now, it would be fun and hours and hours and hours of time to go through each one of the laws that Jesus quoted from and then modified. We first read about murder, which seems so simple. I never murdered anyone. And Jesus said, "Are you reconciled in all your relationships?" Hashtag boom. Right? That's what happened. You go, wow, wow. I like the murder one better. Let's go back to Moses. And then the second one is about adultery. Well, I've never committed adultery because I've never been to bed with another man's wife. Jesus picking on the men who are listening. And they think, I'm in good shape. And Jesus says, adultery, where are your desires? Hashtag boom. We're revealed again and unmasked. And then Jesus reveals for the followers of Jesus that you have heard about divorce laws, and divorce laws in the first century were promiscuous and permissive. If you could find any old reason, and Hillel says, even if your wife burnt your toast, it's justifiable for divorce. And Jesus says, no, stay married. Powerful. Boom. We hear it again. And then Jesus talks about oaths, which seems so simple for us because we don't do that sort of thing. We don't swear by Jerusalem and the temple and gold in the temple. This isn't even an issue for us. But Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Be forthrightly honest so often that you never have to buttress your words with statements like, I really mean this. Which means sometimes you don't mean this. And so Jesus reveals one thing after another of how we as followers of Jesus in the kingdom of God are to live. And as we sit there and we look down the plain onto the Sea of Galilee and we hear the words of Jesus echoing in the valleys, we have heard words so powerful and stunning and deep and penetrating that we know what he's saying and we don't like what he's saying. So we cushion it and we put it in a case so that we don't have to hear these words. But he wants us to hear these words. And he wants us to be people who hear his teachings and try to live them out in this world because he really does mean what he says. And at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, he gives a Baptist-like revival invitation to come follow him and do what he says. I think the whole of the Sermon on the Mount can be summarized in one word, and that word is more. He wants more. In Matthew 5:20, he says you have heard that I've come to destroy the law and the prophets. He says, I want your righteousness to greatly or more surpass the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. At the end of Matthew 5, he says this, what more have you done than Gentiles? He wants more from us than anything that they were seeing in the world at that time. I was a very lucky boy. I was a very lucky sports-loving boy. And I was a very lucky sports-loving boy because my father was a coach at the high school. And when all my friends went home to watch cartoons and eat graham crackers with milk and play with their friends in the neighborhood and in backyards, I went to the high school. And I could roam the hallways. This was before political correctness or anyone was suing schools. People believed in teachers at that time. And so I just roamed the hallways with basketballs and footballs, and I watched the sports teams as my father coached football, then basketball, then track and field, one of the great sports that happens every 4 years in the Olympics. And then he quit coaching football, and he started coaching cross country. But one of my friends, opposed to my neighborhood friends, was a man named Preston Pearson. Now, most of you have never heard of Preston Pearson, so I'll refresh your memory. He's the only NFL player in history to have received or won a Super Bowl ring for three different teams. And I will give you a free copy of my Sermon on the Mount book if you know what teams these are. And I brought one here, but I don't suppose you know, Jay. This is not a musical question at all. But since no one's heard of Preston Pearson, he got a Super Bowl ring with the Baltimore Colts, then the Pittsburgh Steelers, and then the Dallas Cowboys. And he was the first back in NFL history who became a specialist on third down to come out of the backfield to catch passes. Well, Preston was my best friend. Of course, I wasn't his best friend, but he was my best friend. And I would watch him play basketball, and he was an amazing athlete. I remember one of the coaches said, his hands are so big, he can palm a toilet seat. And it was the truth. I saw Preston pick up a basketball one time like this. Well, he was my hero, you know. And then magic happened because the coaches, my father or somebody, one of them was Chris's father, they would tell all the players that they blow the whistle and practice was over, and then the gym was mine. And sometimes with Chris's younger brother. And we would play, and we were Preston Pearson. We'd jump like Preston and shoot like Preston and pretend like we palmed the ball like Preston, which we couldn't, but we thought we could. And he was the greatest pretzel ever. Do you know that was our nickname of our high school team? The Freeport Pretzels. And I couldn't wait to be a pretzel someday. And I was a pretzel, but I wasn't like Preston Pearson. I'm twisted. I'm getting in trouble here. But the coolest thing about Preston that I will ever remember is he was the first person I saw who could pick up a basketball and take it like this and spin it on his finger. And I thought the ultimate act of basketball was being able to spin a ball on your finger. All right, now let me suggest that, and Preston was a superstar at the University of Illinois in basketball, didn't play football, got drafted in the NFL, so I mean, quite an athlete. I look at the Sermon on the Mount in Jesus' words as he's spinning the kingdom ball in front of us. And we, you know, we go home and when he's not around and we try to spin the ball. That's sort of what the Sermon on the Mount is like. We see a beauty of performance in the sermon that we know we will never achieve, but we know we're called to do. Once Chris and I were in the great basilica in Assisi called Basilica San Francesco, the Basilica of St. Francis. And if you know anything about this basilica, it is surrounded with the great azure paintings, blue azure paintings, the life of St. Francis. And I was standing at the back of the church looking at the famous but now faded fresco of St. Francis preaching to the birds. And as I was standing there looking at it, trying to get the right angle because the light wasn't quite right on it, some Americans were leaving the church. I won't tell you what state they were from, but it was noticeable. This is not a comment about the Green Bay Packers. We could make it that. And someone said, "Who painted these paintings?" And the other person said, "I don't know." And then someone said, "It was some medieval guy." And they walked out. And I thought to myself, medieval guy? Giotto di Bondone. One of the greatest painters in medieval history. And by the way, these are not paintings, I thought to myself. These are frescoes. And there's a difference. But if you go into Basilica San Francesco, you will watch people staring at these paintings. Many of them probably not even Christians. But they know there is a form of art here that transcends art that they can perform. And they go home and they pull out their watercolors, you know, and they paint. And little children see these paintings and they try it too. And I think that's what the Sermon on the Mount is. It's the great blue azure paintings of Argiato di Bondone. Is that we see Jesus perform the art of moral life in the kingdom. And we want to be like that. And behind and in front of and to each side and above and below, every saying in the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' word, let them deny themselves. There is a cruciform life at work in the Sermon on the Mount that transforms everything about these sayings. And as we turn to the Eucharist table today, we ingest the bread and the wine as a way of saying not only that Jesus has died for us, but he's painted the paintings of the life we are to live. He has spun the kingdom ball in front of us, and we want to join in on what he's doing in our world today.